Good morning, colleagues. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN Information Service in Geneva. Today is Friday, 16th of October. And before starting, I would like to give the floor to Andrej Mahecic to introduce us a new colleague from UNHCR. Andrej.
Thank you very much, Alessandra. Good morning to everybody. And I'm really sorry that we have to introduce a new colleague under these circumstances. But I'm pleased to welcome on the spokespeople team of UNHCR here in Geneva, my colleague Boris Cheshirkov. Boris has been working with our operation, particularly in Greece, has a lot of experience, and we do hope that you will welcome him. He recently arrived, starting his duties here. All of his contact details can be found also on the same media page with all of our emails and mobile phone numbers. That's only a bit of a housekeeping at the beginning, and I'm sorry to have taken this time, but I'm sure you will join me in welcoming Boris into these briefings. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Andrej. And in fact, not only we welcome Boris, but we will also give him the floor straight away because we will start now with the Sahel. So I would like to ask Jens and Thompson to come on the floor. Marek C is connected via Zoom in order to speak about this subject. I'll step out because we don't have, for social distancing, enough chairs on the podium, but I'll be back to moderate. So Jens, you want to sit in my seat?
Thank you, Alessandra, and good morning, everyone. Next Tuesday, 20th of October, the United Nations, together with Denmark, Germany, and the European Union, will host a ministerial conference on the humanitarian situation in the Central Sahel, which covers Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger. There are three main objectives for this meeting. First, instill a much more acute sense of urgency among policymakers about the situation in the Central Sahel, and emphasize that we need to address the challenges in a comprehensive way. Second, raise money for humanitarian action. Our response plans in the three countries are only about 40% funded, and the crisis is reaching breaking point. Third, encourage both donor countries and the Sahelian countries themselves to offer specific longer-term policy commitments that will help build resilience and stave off future humanitarian needs in the region. So what's at stake? The humanitarian situation has deteriorated sharply over the past 2 years. Needs are rising faster than funding can keep up. People living in the border region between Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger are now at an epicenter of conflict, poverty, and climate change. Without support, we fear that the region could develop into one of the biggest crises in the world. The numbers speak for themselves. More than 13 million people need humanitarian assistance. The number of people facing acute hunger levels have tripled in the past year. And 1.5 million people are now internally displaced, a 20-fold increase over 2 years. Lockdowns and other COVID-19 prevention measures have pushed an additional 6 million people in the region into extreme poverty. In all this, women and children are especially vulnerable, and we are seeing gender-based violence going up. There is enormous potential in the Sahel, and the conference on Tuesday should fully recognize this. We hope that donors will pledge generously and commit to comprehensive action that, in the future, will send humanitarian agencies packing because there's no longer use for them. We've sent you a media advisory yesterday with all the information on how to follow the meeting and access the press conference to ask your questions. At the press conference, we expect to have His Excellency Rasmus Prehn, who is Minister for Development Cooperation from Denmark, Janez Linacic, Commissioner for Crisis Management from the European Union, and Emergency Relief Coordinator and UN Undersecretary General Mark Wilcock. Thank you. Right, Boris, please, the floor is yours.
Many thanks, Jens, and good morning to everyone. It's a pleasure to be here, my first briefing, and I look forward to working closely with all of you in the future. We join OCHA and UNHCR's now warning of the mounting needs in the Sahel as forced displacement intensifies. UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, today warns of disastrous consequences in Africa's Sahel unless humanitarian efforts are urgently supported in what has become the world's fastest growing displacement and protection crisis. Commitments expected to be made at a ministerial roundtable for the Central Sahel on 20th October in Copenhagen can restore a sense of urgency to a region grappling with myriad overlapping challenges. Armed conflict, extreme poverty, food insecurity, climatic changes, and the COVID-19 pandemic converge in the Sahel. Across the wider region, over 2.7 million people have been forced to flee their homes. Shelter, water, sanitation, health, and other basic assistance needs are now immense. The Central Sahel countries of Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger are the epicenter of the forced displacement crisis. More than 1.5 internally displaced people, IDPs, and 365,000 refugees have fled violence in the Central Sahel, including over 600,000 this year alone. The number of IDPs inside Burkina Faso has doubled to over 1 million in the past year. Burkina Faso, among the poorest countries in the world and one of the most susceptible to climate risks, faces a major internal security crisis, which means almost nowhere in the country is safe. The level of brutality against civilians is ghastly and systemic. Parents are being executed in front of their children by armed groups with alarming frequency. Less than 2 weeks ago, on 4th October, in northern Burkina Faso, armed assailants killed 25 men in front of their families in an ambush on their convoy as they were returning home in hope for improved security. Across the region, thousands of women and girls have fallen victim to sexual and gender-based violence. Attacks on schools in the Sahel are a grim and growing reality. More than 3,600 schools in recent years have been destroyed or closed, affecting tens of thousands of school children. Climate risks in the Sahel are also increasing, as rising temperatures are changing rainfall patterns and increasing the frequency and intensity of flooding, droughts, and sandstorms. Recent devastating floods in the region have killed dozens and left hundreds of thousands, many of these displaced in host communities, in urgent need of shelter, clean water, and health services. Host governments and local communities are the first responders and have shown remarkable solidarity. But they are at breaking point, and they need immediate resources. Solutions are urgently needed to address the root causes of displacement and to bolster the humanitarian efforts. Affected states need support to deliver assistance. Governance reforms must be stepped up with the same urgency as life-saving interventions, and adequate resources are essential. Investment is especially needed in urban areas where many of the displaced have sought safety. Humanitarian actors are struggling to meet the snowballing needs of displaced communities and their hosts. UNHCR has dramatically scaled up in the Central Sahel this year. In the Central Sahel, we require continued and sustained financial support. Resources are needed beyond the end of this year for UNHCR and our partners to continue to scale up our assistance. The 20th October Pledging Conference is an opportunity for donors to demonstrate commitment so the most devastating effects can be averted. The time to act in the Sahel is now. Thank you, and we will share our notes.
Thank you very much, Boris, and I will now go to Thompson for WFP, also in Sahel.
Thank you so much, Alessandra. I will talk to you about the food and nutrition security in the Central Sahel that is encompassing Burkina Faso, Niger, and Mali. Now, the Central Sahel region is facing a serious food and nutrition crisis. with some people in parts of northern Burkina Faso on the verge of a hunger catastrophe. 7.4 million people currently do not know where their next meal will come from. Our analysis, as the World Food Programme shows, that an additional 7.4 million could be food insecure before the new year starts. This is as a result of several factors, but not least the socioeconomic effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. We are extremely concerned with two provinces in northern part of Burkina Faso, Oudalan and Soum, which have been driven into the humanitarian emergency phase of food insecurity according to the IPC, which is IPC phase 4. Now, an estimated 11,000 people may just be one step short of famine in places that have been made inaccessible by continued fighting. Devastating floods in September have worsened the food security situation. Floods have destroyed fields, homes, and livelihoods. And we are talking of approximately 500,000 people in Niger and over 100,000 people in Burkina Faso. In Niger, WFP is going to provide food assistance to more than 100,000 people for 1 month. But then again, the upsurge in fighting that we are seeing is an additional pressure to people who are already vulnerable to climatic shocks, and with many of them dependent on seasonal humanitarian assistance. A lot of them have been forced to abandon their fields and livelihoods, and they now depend entirely on host communities who themselves face immense challenges. The ability of humanitarian organizations such as the World Food Programme and many other aid agencies is seriously undermined in the region. Humanitarians are frequently regarded as targets by non-state armed actors across the region, in Burkina, in Mali, in Niger. And this region is on a tipping point. We could see an irreversible slide into chaos, with the risk of a spillover of instability into border areas of neighboring countries around the Gulf of Guinea. This could precipitate further deterioration in food security in West Africa. Now, what is the World Food Programme doing about it? WFP has continued to ramp up its life-saving food and nutrition assistance, as well as our resilience-building activities in the region. A week ago, WFP launched the United Nations Humanitarian Air Service in Burkina Faso to transport aid workers across the country, helping them to reach people in need. WFP already had activities, UNAS activities in Niger, in both Niger and in Mali, connecting isolated communities, flying out of Bamako in Mali to far-flung places like Kidal, like Mopti, like Timbuktu. The same in Niger, we are flying to Zinda, we are flying all over the country to facilitate access to people in need. Now, in August, the World Food Programme reached nearly 3.4 million people in Burkina Faso, in Mali, in Niger. And that assistance is now being scaled up to reach 5 million people. We hope to reach approximately 1.2 million people in Burkina Faso, 1.3 million people in Mali, and 2.5 million people in Niger. I will leave it there.
Thank you very much, Thompson. And the last speaker on this subject is Marixi, who's connected via Zoom. Marixi for UNICEF, you have the floor.
Good morning, can you hear me? Good morning, can you hear me?
Yes, we can, go ahead.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Marixi.
The multiple crises converging in the Central Sahel, including a surge in armed violence and the socio-economic fallout from COVID-19, is worsening conditions for children in one of the world's poorest, least developed regions. A record 7.2 million children in Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger now require humanitarian assistance. This is up two-thirds in just 1 year. Over 1 million children have been forcibly displaced from their homes. safe water, so critical for the survival of young children and for preventing COVID-19, is scarcer than ever, particularly so among those displaced. Estimates on the number of children who will suffer life-threatening malnutrition this year are up by a fifth. Conditions are especially acute in some regions of Burkina Faso that are hosting especially large numbers of displaced people. In Djibo, Gourgadji, and Barsalogho communes, mortality rates among children already exceed the emergency alert threshold. Across the three countries, targeted attacks had already shut down over 4,000 schools before COVID-19 closed down the rest. Verified instances of grave violations against children, which include recruitment into the fighting and rape and sexual violence, have risen, especially in Mali. UNICEF is working with partners to reach children with life-saving therapeutic food, immunization against deadly disease, and access to safe water and sanitation. We are supporting children who have been released from armed groups or subjected to sexual violence to recover and reintegrate. And we are supporting countries in their efforts to expand distance and remote learning through TV, radio, and paper-based instruction, and to help make schools safe enough to reopen amid COVID-19. UNICEF's operations in the Central Sahel are critically underfunded, and we need more help. As of mid-October, UNICEF has received less than a third, 31% of the $210 million it needs in the three countries for humanitarian assistance this year, and just slightly over half against our 65.7 million COVID-19 appeal. If the Central Sahel is to extricate itself from chronic crises, then these countries must make sure that this generation of children is able to turn the page on violence and poverty. That can only do so by protecting, educating, and nurturing children, no matter their circumstances. For that, the Central Sahel will need far more resources now and for years to come. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marixi. Thanks, colleagues, for this important briefing. I would like now to open the floor to questions. I look at the room first. I don't see any hand up. I see Nina has a question. Nina Larson.
Yes, hi, thank you for taking my question. I guess it's for Jens. I just want to ask about the format of this event next week. It looks virtual, but is it being hosted in Copenhagen or here? Are there some hybrid events? Are there any possibilities of seeing people in person? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Nina. Yes, officially it is hosted by Denmark in Copenhagen and co-hosted by Germany, the European Union, and ourselves from the UN. In effect, it's a virtual event. So it will happen online. As you can see in the media advisory, the whole thing will be live streamed, so you can follow that. And then we have the press conference, which will be with a Zoom link, so that you can ask questions, and that will be at 4 p.m. in the afternoon. I hope that answers it.
Thank you, Jens. Gabriele?
Hello? Yes.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much. My question is for Thompson. He mentioned that 7.5 or 7.4, I don't know exactly the number, million doesn't know where the food is coming, the next meal will come. So, and then 7.5 or 7.4 more will fall in that category, but are you prepared to feed all those people?
Thank you, Gabriela. Indeed, 7.4 million people right now are hungry. And that number will double by the end of the year. That means approximately 14.8 million people, around 15 million people across the Central Sahel will be unable to meet their daily food needs. Now, the World Food Programme is only scaling up to assist those that are, we usually target the most vulnerable. We will scale up to reach 5 million across the entire region, across Central Sahel. And as you can imagine, we had planned, we were assisting 3.3 million people around the region, but we are going to scale up now. And the needs are outstripping available resources. And as I speak, the World Food Programme agency needs 178 million to be able to mount an effective response starting now and through the through March 2021. So for the next 6 months.
Thank you very much, colleagues. I don't see any other questions. So I would like to ask the colleagues on the podium, sorry, this is the situation, oblige us to do so, to step down, and I will ask Tariq and our guest to join me on the podium. Thank you. So thank you very much. Tariq is here with a guest today, Dr. Bente Mikkelsen, who is the director of the Department of Non-Communicable Diseases of WHO. So you would like to start, Tariq, or we give the floor straight to Dr.
I think we can give the floor straight to Dr. Mikkelsen. Just to let you know that we have one more colleague online. It's Dr. Cherian Vergez, who may also help with answering some of your questions regarding hypertension. So the floor is for Bente.
Dr. Mikkel.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. So I'm here in the occasion of the World Hypertension Day. So as you know very well, we are in a very critical juncture on the COVID-19 pandemic. So of course, after some time of success in suppressing transmission, many countries are now again experiencing a resurgence after easing of restrictions. And with also the flu season coming, we know that it will be even a more difficult time for countries to make the right choices and to find themselves to strike the right balance between protecting public health, protecting personal liberties, and also keeping the economy going. We have witnessed that the virus has preyed on people with non-communicable diseases such as hypertension. And this may come to some surprise for some of you, but the pandemic has underscored the urgency of addressing hypertension. So today, on the World Hypertension Day, which aims to increase accountability by governments, policymakers, industry, academia, and also civil society to reduce the burden of hypertension globally and in every country to increase equality. So it's a very important day, both for COVID and for hypertension. I'm pleased today to launch new products coming out of WHO that will help, that will give solutions to countries, and that will call urgent action on hypertension during and beyond the pandemic. So the hypertension situation, the high blood pressure, is not on hold. Therefore, we cannot postpone action to help 1 billion people to keep their blood pressure under control. And this is extremely important because preventing and controlling blood pressure is also the main road into controlling stroke, heart attack, and also kidney damage. So addressing COVID-19 and high blood pressure at the same time is very important, and we need a stronger response to safeguard lives and livelihoods. Not helping people to manage their blood pressure is even more damaging under the time of crisis, like in the world is around today, seeing the amid of COVID-19. So what we have seen, and this has been like an X-ray, is that during COVID, we have had a deadly interplay between COVID-19 and non-communicable diseases and hypertension among them. So what we have seen is that there has been an increased fatality rate among people with hypertension. We have also, of course, seen delays in diagnosis of hypertension resulting in more advanced disease stages. And the disruption of healthcare system to deliver has, of course, caused very huge damage on people with living with hypertension, not being able to deliver medicines or being able to be controlled by their doctors in hospitals or even communities. To add to that, we have also seen that there has been an increase in the risk factors that leads to hypertension. So, for example, we all know that unhealthy food is one of the, and especially high salt content, is one of the bigger risk factors for hypertension, as well as physical inactivity. So this has been a challenging time and had added to the stress on people who was at risk for hypertension during COVID. So coming back to the solutions, what we launched today is a new report, and the report represents solutions. We have seen that putting in place the right policies actually can reduce blood pressure. And the proof point of this is that we have been able to document that we now cover 3 million more people in control of hypertension in 18 countries. We are also launching a set of fact sheets, so all these 18 countries can now go into the fact sheets and everybody else can see what policies are put in place, what is the challenges, and how did they actually make this positive development happen. We are also very pleased to launch a new training course. This is developed by PAHO, and it's really important because it's accessing the performance of blood pressure measurements by doctors, nurses, and midwives and pharmacists on how to improve. I know I have very few times left. I just want to add a couple of comments on what these measures are, so you have some ideas. So when it comes to the solution for keeping control of hypertension, it's really about applying standard protocols. It's about access to medicines. It's about uninterrupted supply of medicine. And it's also about monitoring and data. And of course, the training is really about addressing the needs of the healthcare personnel. And especially, and this may surprise you, that it is really about how to measure blood pressure in the right way. So I will stop by just saying that we use this day to ask countries to align their COVID-19 recovery and building back better, together with using the new tools from WHO. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Oops, sorry. Thank you very much to you, Dr. Mikkelsen. I'll open the floor to questions for Dr. Mikkelsen, Tariq, and the other colleague online. The first one is Nina Larsson from AFP. Nina.
Yes, hi, can you hear me? Hello?
Yes, now you can. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for taking my question. So I actually have two questions. On hypertension, I haven't seen this report. I assume we'll receive it. Sorry if I missed it, but do you have any indication in percentages or numbers of increases in deaths linked to hypertension due amid the COVID crisis? And for Tariq, I had a separate question, and it is on the study that was published overnight indicating that remdesivir doesn't have any effect basically on mortality in terms of when it comes to COVID. Could you say something more about that? And so I know it's not peer reviewed, if you could give us a few more details on how confident WHO is in those findings. Thank you.
Okay, I'll start with Dr. Mikkelsen, please.
So I'll be brief. So when it comes to COVID-19 and hypertension, the 122 countries that has reported tells us that in over 50% of the countries, the services in the healthcare services is disrupted fully or partially, 50% of the countries. And in addition, we see high number of fatalities. We don't have global figures yet, but we see in the range of 50-60% of the people that are severely ill and die in hospitals from COVID have hypertension, diabetes, and so forth. And we are working on the global targets.
Tariq?
Thanks. Nina, you have seen we have issued a press release last night. So I think that that explains what we have. And I would really prefer to have my colleagues who have in-depth technical knowledge on this to answer these questions at the press briefing that is today at 5 o'clock. But just like to summarize the press release, the interim results from the Solidarity Therapeutics trial coordinated by the World Health Organization indicate that remdesivir, hydroxychloroquine, lopinavir, ritonavir, and interferon regimens appear to have little or no effect on 28-day mortality or the in-hospital course of COVID-19 among hospitalized patients. Although the results for the first four treatment options evaluated were unpromising, this global platform works well and is now available to rapidly evaluate promising new treatment options with nearly 500 hospitals participating as trial sites. So I will really invite you to follow the press briefing today and ask questions. We will have Dr. Soumya Swaminathan, who is our chief scientist, to answer those questions.
Thank you very much. Lisa Schlein, Voice of America, on the line.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my question. I probably missed some of your statistics when you were talking, but I think you said 1 billion people in the world were affected by hypertension. Could you clarify that? How many people actually die from hypertension, high blood pressure? And I imagine this is a major risk factor of COVID-19 and that many people are might not be dying if they didn't have high blood pressure, if you could talk about that. And then what is the situation regarding the developed and developing countries? Where is it worst? Is it, you talk about bad food and all sorts of things. So if you could elaborate upon that, please. Thank you.
So first of all, I just want to correct one thing. So the health profiles is from 80 countries, it's not from the 18 countries. So so that is a correction. So when it comes to the numbers of hypertension, so we have 1.130 billion people that has hypertension. And most of these people actually live in low and middle income countries. So other statistics is, and they are really not very, you know, good news, but the good news is that we know what to do. But if you look at it, only 1 out of 10 countries had at least half of the population with hypertension under treatment. And only 4 out of 5 low and middle income countries have less than half of their people on hypertension treatment. So again, you can see it's especially the low and middle income countries that are at risk. And you asked again about the COVID-19 and the figures. We cannot give global figures at a global level for the risk. So we have figures from many countries that we have published. So for example, in Italy, we know that 64% of those dying in hospital from COVID-19 has hypertension. So we have national figures, but we are working on the global figures.
Jamil.
Yes, thank you. Tariq, just a question on the study that was published overnight. First of all, this was a study that we were all waiting for many months. Why was it sent during the night? We don't have a problem working during the night, but if we had a heads on, look, this is going to come, don't sleep tonight, we would not sleep. Why is it that a report so big like this comes in an email during the night and without any warning from your side? This is the first question. Secondly, with this study, making very clear some issues there with hydrochloroquine and the medical means. What is your suggestion to presidents that officially promote these drugs? Thank you.
Jamil, on the we can't always choose the time of the release of reports.
No, we'll choose it.
Can you please let Tariq answer? Thank you.
We cannot always choose the timing of the reports. Quite often, we can only imagine under what pressures we are working right now, and trying to get the best possible advice to countries, to general public. We also try to, as knowledge comes in, present this knowledge, because this knowledge and results of different trials in different areas help shape this advice. We are trying really our best, and I think you will appreciate that. As soon as we get information ready, we try to release it. Again, so regarding this particular study, as I said, we hope that that this platform that that is now being used will be used for other treatments, and it shows basically that that even during pandemic, we can come together and do massive trials and try to get solutions.
Peter.
Yeah, hold on. I'm just going to switch this off.
Peter, we always have the same problem. You're speaking from the room, not from the platform. So for my colleagues, don't activate the mic. Otherwise, we have an echo. Peter in the room. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm just switching this off.
Yes, Doctor, you said that hypertension is mostly common in lower and middle income countries. Is hypertension easy to combat?
So I think it would be wrong to say easy, but we have the solutions. We know how to do it. And I think it's very good news that we today see 3 million more people on treatment. But, you know, still, as we celebrate today the World Hypertension Day, it's very clear that, you know, 2 of the 5 people are unaware that they have hypertension. So it's not only about treatment, it's really raising the awareness. It's to training doctors and nurses to be able to both diagnose and control. And we know that 4 out of 5 people in low and middle income countries are not on treatment. So, of course, we have a big challenge, but we have the solutions as well. So I think for me, this is sort of a day of celebration, because we can prove, we have the proof that when we do the right things, we can actually support. And it's even more important now during COVID. Thank you for the question.
Thank you very much.
So, what type of people must be on the lookout for hypertension? Thank you.
Sorry, I didn't get
it. What type of people would have to be on the look for hypertension?
So, you know, it is an age component, but it's also, of course, that we know that people that has already a lot of risk factors, being inactive, being overweight, smokers, you know, all of those are, of course, at risk. So the first thing to do is to really reduce all these risk factors. So, and I think the well-trained healthcare personnel are very aware how to sort of institute, but these are one of the easiest things to diagnose if you use blood pressure measurement correctly. So I think the focus on risk factors, the awareness that so many actually are undiagnosed yet, and then, of course, to really reinforce the treatment is the message of the day. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. We have a long list of speakers waiting, so I will take the last two questions, Moussa and Gabriel, and then we go to the next speaker. Moussa online. Can my colleague
unmute? Oui, c'est bon.
Yes. You're on.
C'est bon. Ma question pour Tariq sur la COVID-19 en Europe. Est-ce que l'OMS s'attendait à une augmentation si importante en Europe? Est-ce qu'il y a des raisons spécifiques pour ça et quelle est l'opinion de l'OMS sur les mesures qui ont été prises ou bien qui vont être prises en Europe, qui ont été annoncées en France, en Allemagne et un peu partout? Merci.
Oui, merci pour la question. Donc, notre directeur régional pour Europe, Dr. Hans Kluge, a tenu la conférence de presse hier où il a adressé exactement cette question et où il a dit que les réponses actuelles sont la réponse, en fait, à un nombre qui augmente des cas partout en Europe et ces mesures sont nécessaires. Ce qu'on n'arrête pas de dire, c'est que le Conseil de l'OMS, c'est que les mesures devraient être vraiment ciblées. On devrait faire des choses rapidement pour trouver où se trouve le virus, parce que le confinement général devrait être vraiment le dernier outil à utiliser. Ça serait beaucoup mieux vraiment d'essayer de découvrir où se trouvent les foyers d'infection, d'isoler donc ceux qui sont infectés, que ces gens-là soient pris en charge aussi et qu'on fait donc on essaye d'identifier les personnes qui ont pu être en contact direct avec eux et essayer de telle manière isoler le virus de la population au lieu d'isoler les gens les uns des autres.
Thank you very much. Last question, Gabriela.
Thank you very much for giving me the question. Can you remind us, Tariq, which medication does work? I mean, only dexamethasone?
You can try. Maybe Dr. Melton. No, it's okay.
Yes, you will remember that we had issued a press release on dexamethasone saying that it has a positive effect with severely ill patients. And so this has been conclusion of the Solidarity trial on four. I will just repeat again on four drugs that remdesivir, hydroxychloroquine, lopinavir, ritonavir, and interferon. And the trial found that those drugs have little or no effect on mortality for hospitalized patients. I will stop there. Yeah.
Thank you, Tariq. Dr. Mikkelsen would like to say one final word, and then we go to the next speaker, please.
So I just wanted to welcome you to an event later today when we want to launch the tools and where Dr. Cherian Varghese will speak more about the heart packet, and it will be with Dr. Tedros, Dr. Tom Frieden and CEO, President Resolve to Save Life, and also Dr. Didier Drogba, President of the Didier Drogba Foundation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mikkelsen, and thank you, Tariq, for being with us. And I go now to Andrei for HCR, who's going to talk us about Libya life-saving flights. I'll take off my mask. While Andrei is coming on the podium, I would just like to remind you that we have sent you a note to correspondent that was on Wednesday about the meeting of the 5+5 Libyan Joint Military Commission in Geneva next week. Some of you have asked questions about media events in the framework of this meeting, and obviously we will give you a bit more information, but we don't expect that's what I wanted to say, because some of you have asked that we don't expect activities on Monday morning, but during the weekend we will try to give you more information on what we will have for the press for this meeting. And I'll go to Andrei now on the issue of the flights. Andrei.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I will be giving you a short briefing about the evacuation flights we've resumed from Libya. Last night, we evacuated a group of 153 vulnerable refugees and asylum seekers out of Libya to the emergency transit mechanism in Niger. This chartered flight marks the resumption of life-saving evacuations from Libya, ending a seven-month-long suspension. These humanitarian flights had to be halted in March due to the public health concerns related to the coronavirus pandemic, which led then to the suspension of air traffic in many countries. Those evacuated yesterday include nationals of Eritrea, Somalia, Sudan, and South Sudan. These also included 16 families and 15 children under the age of 18, many of whom are unaccompanied or separated from their parents. With COVID-19 cases continuing to rise in Libya and some 46,000 confirmed cases across the country, all passengers tested negative prior to departure. They were also given counseling and awareness sessions on how to stay protected and healthy. The group is now undergoing a two-week quarantine in Niger and a further test in line with the health measures to curb the spread of the coronavirus. The majority of evacuees were living in the Libyan capital, Tripoli. Virtually all of them, 97% of the group, have experienced arbitrary detention in Libya, including in Tajoura, Zintan, or Trik al-Sika detention centers. Some of them have been detained for more than 2 years in extremely dire conditions and were recently released thanks to UNHCR's advocacy with the Libyan authorities. More than 3,400 migrants and asylum seekers are currently estimated to be held in government-run detention centers in Libya, where conditions are dire and many are at risk of serious abuse. The resumption of evacuation flights is especially important now, given the volatile situation in Libya, the rapid spread of the coronavirus and its health, as well as socioeconomic impact on refugees and asylum seekers who have found it increasingly difficult to support themselves and their families. I'll stop there. There are a few more details in the briefing note. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Andrei. I'm looking at the room. Is there any question on Libya for HCR? I don't see any online. There is Lisa.
Hi, Andre. Nice to see you.
Hi, Lisa.
Virtually. On this situation, do you anticipate more flights? I mean, you say that more than, 3,400 migrants are still detained, apparently in abusive conditions. If you can talk about that, do you have any visiting rights with these people? Do you believe that any of them will be released and that you will be able to have more of these essentially life-saving flights out of the country?
Yes, we do hope that the flights will now continue. They have resumed after 7 months. We've obviously been working and advocating with the Libyan authorities to release those. We continue to reiterate the call to the Libyan authorities to release all asylum seekers that are held in detention and for an end, actually, to arbitrary detention. Now, the people who were released thanks to the measures and decisions that were taken by the Libyan authorities. We plan to continue this process, and it's important that to know that so far, this year, out of two flights, there was the one in February, and the one that landed yesterday, in total, we have brought 501 vulnerable refugees out of Libya, including 221 who have so far been resettled to Europe.
Lisa, is that the follow-up?
Yes, it is, Alessandra. Haven't heard much news out of Libya recently in terms of the migration. I was wondering if you could speak about whether migrations in more people from Africa are migrating to Libya, or has that essentially stopped because of the difficulties?
I let Andre answer, but we also have on the line Paul Dillon for IOM. In case, Paul, you want to add something. Andre.
The migratory movements across the continent continue, and the scale of those are very difficult to pin down, given that most of them are happening in clandestine conditions through smugglers and people traffickers. So it is very difficult to gauge the scope of that movement. Colleagues from IOM may want to add more, but right now the estimate is that there are 45,660 refugees and asylum seekers throughout the country. Many of them, for those that we know that are being held in the government detention centers, we advocate for their release. We also advocate for the release of people who might be held in any other possible such facilities, and we know that there are many, given the volatile and fragmented situation inside Libya, that there are probably many other detention centers that we do not also know of.
Thank you very much, Andrea. I don't see any other question in the room or online, so thank you. And I'll now turn to Ravina on my left. Ravina, it's the one under the mic. Welcome, and you have a point on Bolivia. Go ahead.
That's right. Good morning, everyone. You should have received a press release on Bolivia that we issued in English and Spanish just about 20 minutes ago. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, has urged Bolivia's authorities, political and other actors, to refrain from any actions that could undermine the peaceful conduct of the general elections that are taking place this Sunday. In light of the political and human rights crises that were unleashed during the previous attempt to carry out these elections a year ago, Bachelet has expressed her hope that Sunday's elections would take place in a calm, participatory, and inclusive manner, in an environment that ensures respect for human rights of all people in Bolivia. We welcome the Bolivian people's determination to participate in these elections. Everyone should be able to exercise the right to vote in peace without intimidation or violence. These elections represent an opportunity to really move forward on social and economic fronts and to diffuse the extreme polarization that has been plaguing Bolivia over the past few years. The High Commissioner has expressed her serious concern at the inflammatory language and threats that have been made by some political actors in recent weeks, as well as the increasing number of physical attacks that have been taking place. It is essential, the High Commissioner says, that all sides avoid further acts of violence that could spark a confrontation. No one wants to see a repeat of last year's events, which led to extensive human rights violations and abuses, including at least 30 people killed and more than 800 injured, and ultimately to everyone losing out. The UN Human Rights Office has deployed a mission to Bolivia. The mission has been there since November 2019, and it remains in the country to monitor and report on any human rights violations and abuses, including in the context of elections.
Thank you very much, Ravina. I see a couple of questions online. Nick Cumming-Bruce.
Yeah, thank you. It's not actually on Bolivia, though. Can if Nina wants to ask about Bolivia?
Nina has a question on Bolivia, then I'll come back to you. Nina.
Yeah, hi. Sorry, no, mine isn't on Bolivia either.
I think Gabriela has a question on Bolivia, or maybe not. Gabriela.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, it was on election.
Okay.
USA.
So if anybody in the room, I don't see any hand up. So I'll go in order of request of floor for non-Bolivian questions, non-Bolivia related questions. And we'll start with Nick.
Thanks. Hi, Ravina. Good to see you. I have a question about Thailand, actually. We've got considerable protests there, and given the history of some of these protests ending in extreme violence. Is this an issue of concern to OHCHR? And do you have any details on the number of arrests that have been taking place as a result of the military action to the recent protests?
Thanks, Nick. Yes, good morning. As you know, we do have a regional office in Bangkok, and so we have been following very closely the situation in light of the recent public demonstrations, and we've conducted some monitoring ourselves as well. Now, the demonstrations themselves have largely been peaceful, and the authorities have largely respected the state space for the exercise of the right to peaceful assembly. But we are concerned that yesterday morning they imposed a serious emergency situation in Bangkok as a result of the rally that was held the day before, which was actually largely peaceful. The imposition of the decree will negatively impact on the exercise of fundamental freedoms as guaranteed by the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, to which Thailand is a party. We are concerned about the detention and arrest of many activists and human rights defenders as well, including those who are associated with the demonstrations. The last figures that we have are that 57 individuals were arrested between the 13th and the 16th of October. Six of them have been released, and the rest remain, as of today, in police custody. And we are particularly concerned about the application of a number of serious charges, including the crime of sedition, against individuals for peacefully exercising their fundamental rights. Now, we're calling on the government to ensure that no one is targeted, detained, or charged with serious offenses for exercising their fundamental rights to freedom of peaceful assembly and expression, and to ensure that due process rights and judicial safeguards are systematically provided for every person who is arrested and detained, including routine access to their lawyers and to their families at all times.
And I will remind you that the Secretary General also said in a message a few weeks ago that no one should be arrested or go to jail for their political views. And people have a fundamental right to express themselves, demonstrate peacefully, speak up, and it's incumbent on authorities to allow people to do so, give them the space to do so, use restraint if they feel there is violence in the demonstration. Nick, you have a follow-up?
Yeah, just a quick one to ask if there had been contact between OHCHR and Thai authorities and what reaction you're getting to them from that.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, there's been a lot of contact. As I mentioned, we've got a regional office in Bangkok, so there's been contact at that level, letters, meetings, as well as in Geneva. So we have been engaging very closely with them, and you know, everything that I've just said, we've also made these views known to them.
Thank you. Nina, your turn. What's your question about?
Let's see. Yeah, hi. My question was about Israel. We're seeing a report out yesterday that that a number of staff from OHCHR have been denied visas to Israel since the publication of the database in February. Is that correct? And could you give us some details and how, what kind of communication do you have with the Israeli authorities about this? Thank you.
Hi, Nina. Thanks for your question. Yes, indeed. So just to clarify, no visas have been renewed of our staff in the country since June. And the first international staff member had to leave in August after her visa expired. The visa applications, to be clear, have not been formally refused, but the Israeli authorities have abstained from issuing or renewing any visas since June. I mean, it's an ongoing process. Our offices have not been closed. We still have some national staff working inside the occupied Palestinian territory, along with some remaining international staff. The rest of our international staff are working remotely. Now, as you're aware, because of the pandemic, in any case, a lot of our staff are not able to work physically from their offices at all times. So the work is continuing. But of course, this is a highly irregular situation, and it will negatively impact on our ability to carry out our mandate. We do continue to hope that the situation will be resolved soon, and we are actively engaged with various relevant and concerned parties to resolve the situation.
Thank you very much. Last question from Gabriella, and then we will go to our guest.
Yes, Gabriella. Thank you very much. Hi, hello. Hi, Rabina. Nice to see you. Two questions, if may I. One is on USA elections, and there's also inflammatory language there. There's a news channel inciting to hate. The president didn't condemn white supremacists. So could you comment on this situation in the United States prior to the elections? And also on Mexico, freedom of expression. The president of Mexico, this is the second time, he puts a list on a big screen in his press conference with the names of all the columnists, journalists who write criticizing his government. And then these journalists are harassed on the networks, you know, in the social media by the president's followers. So this is very worrying.
for the exercise of press freedom in Mexico. If you can comment on that as well. Thanks.
Thanks, Gabriela, for the two questions. On hate speech in the context of elections, now, you know the High Commissioner's position on this. Now, just now we've spoken about the use of inflammatory language in Bolivia. I believe last week we issued a press release on Guinea with, you know, hate speech and inflammatory language being used there. And the High Commissioner's position has been clear. She's consistently underlined the need to combat speech that can amount to incitement to hatred and to violence. And she's made these views known very clearly in various fora. And the High Commissioner would like to see political leadership globally take a stance against, a strong and clear stance against the use of hate speech and speech that could amount to incitement to hatred or violence against any particular groups. On the situation in Mexico, as you know, our office in Mexico has been very closely following the situation of freedom of expression and you know, the difficult situation of journalists in the country. If there's anything specific that they can provide you with on this specific incident, I'll get back to you. But generally, we have expressed our concerns with the situation of journalists and human rights defenders in Mexico.
Thank you very much, Ravina. I would like now, thank you very much for being with us. I'd like now to turn to, again, to WFP, who is going to talk to us about a report. But before doing that, sorry, I take my mask, it's nicer. I just would like to remind everybody, I think we all know that today is World Food Day, and it also concludes a World Food Week that has seen a lot of events happening. The Secretary General of the United Nations has issued a message today that has been distributed to you, in which he says that the award of this year's Nobel Prize for Peace to the UN World Food Programme recognizes the right of all people to food and our common quest to achieve zero hunger. He goes on saying that the COVID-19 pandemic has further intensified food insecurity to a level not seen in decades. As we mark the 75th anniversary of the UN Food and Agricultural Organization, we need to intensify our efforts to achieve the vision of the Sustainable Development Goals. On this World Food Day, he concludes, let us make a commitment to grow, nourish, and sustain together. And on these words of the Secretary General, I would like to give the floor now to Mr. Arif Hussein, who's the chief economist of the World Food Programme, who is talking to us via Zoom, I guess, from Rome.
Yes, well.
So, Mr. Hussein, go ahead, please. You have the floor.
Thank you so much. Can you hear me okay?
Very well, thank you.
Okay. So good morning, everybody. I would just start by saying that this report, which is about, you know, how much does a plate of food cost in different parts of the world? I mean, it should not surprise, the results of this report should not surprise anybody. I mean, it simply says that millions amongst us cannot afford even a basic plate of food. And why? There are essentially three things which we see. First and foremost, I mean, it is about conflict. Conflict drives large numbers of people from their homes, from their lands, from their jobs, which affects productivity and their income and their purchasing power. In many countries, because of conflict, now we are looking at generational losses because many, many years, if not decades, have gone past by. I think, Romina, like was said, basically the Nobel Peace Prize is the recognition that food security and peace and stability must go hand in hand, and we need to get to do that. The second reason which we see is essentially climate extremes. More frequent and intense climate shocks today than more than 20 years ago. 100 shocks on average 20 years ago, today more than 200 shocks. And they are damaging our food system. That produce the food which we need, and that is what makes food unaffordable to many, many people. Then the third thing which we see is economic downturns. we are seeing rising debts, falling currencies, increasing inequalities, not just in incomes, but also in opportunities. And to top all of this, COVID-19 exasperates an already bad situation. I mean, in a way, it is creating this economic quicksand, you know, where hunger is up, poverty is up, unemployment is up, and local food prices are up. But at the same time, you got incomes going down, you got informal remittances going down, and hence purchasing power of the people. So at the end of the day, I mean, you know, we need to do enough to get people out of this quicksand. Because if that is not done, it is going to take a lot longer, and it is going to take a lot more resources to get people out of the problems that they face today, exasperated by COVID-19. Now, what this plate of food does is, and it looks in somewhere around 36 countries in terms of how much does it cost for a very basic plate of food. And what we see is that out of the, you know, top 20, 17 countries are in sub-Saharan Africa, where the prices, if you will, the highest. And why is that the case? Because of imports, because of the global conditions, because of declining currencies, rising inflation, all of those things put together. The country which tops the list, that is essentially South Sudan. What is happening there is that if you wanted a simple, nice, basic plate of food, it would cost you 186% of your daily wage, meaning you cannot afford it. And what COVID has done, it has added about 27 percentage points more to that cost compared to pre-COVID time. We are also really, really concerned about, we talked about Sahel earlier, but we are also really concerned about South Sudan, the violence which is happening in Jonglei, in Greater Fibor State. You have already 60,000 people who are displaced. You have catastrophic flooding. And on top of that, you have a currency which is falling like you wouldn't believe, and it is rising essentially then the cost of food. I mean, prices have increased by 35%. Food prices have increased by 35% just within the 3 weeks of the onset of, you know. And if you look at the currency, that has declined by 67% September to September between 2019 and 2020. So these things then directly affect people's ability to afford food. And then that, not having that ability, then contributes to violence as well. The problem is that even in South Sudan, that is the case, but in South Sudan, in Sudan itself, also prices are up by about 200% compared to last year. That, again, declining currencies, flooding, which is supposed to affect about a third of sorghum production in Sudan, which is going to have an impact on South Sudan. So when you combine all of these factors together, you're seeing that how the key causes, the main reasons, what I said, conflict, climate extremes, economic marginalization, and then on top of that, COVID, which is exacerbating all of that, is creating these situations in many, many parts. I will stop here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hussain. I'm looking now at my list of journalists here. If anybody would like to ask a question toward the program or in the room, I don't see any hand up. But before we leave, so thank you very much, Mr. Hussain, and thanks, Thompson. But before we leave the issue of food, I would just like to remind you, Adriano could not be with us today, but he asked me to remind you that today the World Food Day ceremony organized by the FAO will bring together in Rome heads of the Rome-based UN agencies and other keynote speakers together with the FAO Director General to a ceremony that will take place at 2 p.m. Rome time. The digital event will also include messages and calls to action from His Holiness the Pope Francis, the President of the Republic of Italy, and of course the Secretary General. This event is can be followed by a webinar or webcast. And there will also be at 7:30 p.m., there will be a video mapping show at the Colosseum in Rome and on the facade of the FAO headquarters building that will show all the data and the people who have continued to produce, plant, harvest, fish, or transport our food despite these challenging times. This is also available online. So this is what we had on World Food Day. And I like, we have still three speakers online that have been patiently waiting, and I thank them for that. So I will start now to give the floor to UNECE, Jean Rodriguez, who has also an announcement on a handbook they are publishing. Jean.
Good morning, everyone. Do you hear me correctly?
We do, go ahead.
So UNECE is launching today a handbook on sustainable urban mobility and spatial planning to help cities steer their green recovery. The COVID-19 pandemic has profoundly impacted urban mobility and has raised fundamental questions about its future role at the heart of urban development. Before the pandemic, new forms of shared and connected urban mobility were rapidly taking root. Although lockdowns halted the daily movements of millions of people, shifts to active forms of mobility received a boost in many cities, such as through the establishment of pop-up cycling lanes. The handbook recalls that the transport sector produces a quarter of greenhouse gas emissions in the EU, and that approximately 42% of the 105,000 road traffic deaths recorded annually in the UNECE region occur in built-up areas. Furthermore, the cost of delays in passenger transport and cargo due to congestion in Europe is estimated at around 100 billion euros per year, which is just over 1% of GDP of the EU. Making urban transport systems greener and more efficient, therefore, presents important benefits for health, the climate, and for cities' prosperity, with the potential to drive a sustainable recovery from COVID-19. The handbook, which was developed in the framework of the Transport, Health and Environment Pan-European Programme, called the PEP, which we administer jointly with the WHO Europe, provides case studies, good practices, and examples from cities from across the region. Let me mention just a few examples. Almaty in Kazakhstan created a high-speed bus corridor, which now transports 140,000 passengers daily, reducing travel times by 20%. In 2018, over 100 kilometers of dedicated lanes for public transport and 80 kilometers of cycling path were commissioned, and an urban bike rental system was introduced. In Copenhagen, a role model for cities striving to develop cycling, the cost of 1 kilometer of cycling path is recovered after 5 years, thanks to the improved health of the users. Approximately 41% of citizens travel to work or to school by bicycle, saving about 235 million of euros per year in health and economic costs. In Moscow, car sharing and bike sharing systems have been introduced in the last years and result in 30,000 car sharing trips and over 27,000 bicycle trips per day. The city has also implemented sophisticated intelligent transport system, which produce road user information, automated traffic management, and televiewing systems that harmonize traffic flows and speed up response to emergency situations. In Basel, the Sustainable Urban Mobility Plan has led to significant improvements, including a reduction of car traffic in spite of the growing population registered, high accessibility for the entire Basel region, especially by public transport, a significant increase in the number of cyclists, and noticeable improvements in road safety and air quality. Building on city experiences, the handbook outlines a series of practical recommendations for cities and decision makers. First, public transport improvements have to be given priority with appropriate funding. Second, in this respect, the key priorities must include the replacement of polluting bus fleets by non-polluting new models, the promotion of electromobility, the development of modern trams and intermodal hubs, and the drawing of appropriate land management policies. Walking and cycling also need to be supported, not just in urban city centers, but on a much larger scale in combination with other modes of transport, especially public transport. And finally, cities can make the most of a new generation of intelligent transport systems by harnessing financial and technological opportunities offered by digitalization. The handbook is available in English and Russian, and the press release is available in English, French, and Russian. And we stay at your disposal if you have any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jean. I'm looking at the room and online. Let me go up, sorry. No, I don't see any question for you, Jean. Thank you very much then. I'll go to Sophie Fisher. Thank you for your patience, Sophie. You have a briefing on another report, an announcement, another report on behalf of ILO. Sophie Fisher.
Yes, good morning, everybody. My apologies for not appearing to you on video, but I am still working from home and the video connection where I am is quite unstable. I wanted to tell you about a report that we will be launching next Wednesday, the 21st of October. It is on the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on the garment sector in Asia Pacific. This report will assess the impact of the crisis on supply chains, factories, and workers in 10 major garment producing countries in the region. As you all well know, retail sales in countries where there have been stringent lockdowns have pretty much collapsed. Asia Pacific is important because it employs 65 million garment sector workers. Those are figures from 2019. That is the 75% of all the world's garment workers. And the region also accounts for 60% of the world's total apparel exports. Now, the 10 garment producing countries that will be featured in the report are Bangladesh, Cambodia, China, India, Indonesia, Myanmar, Pakistan, the Philippines, Sri Lanka, and Vietnam. The report and the accompanying press release will be available under embargo from Monday, that's the 19th. Please email us in the newsroom at ILO if you are interested in receiving a copy. The embargo on this report will be lifted at 11 a.m. Geneva time on Wednesday, the 21st. Now, this is actually a regional report which has been produced by the ILO's office in Bangkok. So they will be hosting the embargoed virtual presser, which will commence in English at 10 a.m. Geneva time on Wednesday, the 21st. The press conference is also being opened up to interested Palais journalists via Zoom, and you will be able to ask questions via Zoom. Excuse me. Please let us know in advance if you would like to attend so we can send you the details. We will also be sending out a media advisory with full details in due course. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sophie. Any question for ILO? I don't see any, so thank you very much. Good luck for the launch. I go to our last, but definitely not least speaker, Catherine for ANCTAD, also another announcement on a
Oui, bonjour. Oui, bonjour à tous. C'est mercredi prochain, la CNUSED va également publier son update sur le commerce mondial, qui bien sûr mesure l'impact des bouleversements économiques et sociaux provoqués par le COVID-19 sur les échanges entre les pays. On sait déjà que la COVID-19 a entraîné une forte réduction du commerce mondial. Elle a été mesurée au deuxième trimestre 2020 avec une baisse de 20% à peu près, comparé au même trimestre en 2019. Les données préliminaires que nous avons pour le troisième trimestre suggèrent que, tout en montant un léger redressement par rapport au deuxième trimestre 2020, la croissance du commerce mondial reste négative au troisième trimestre par rapport au troisième trimestre 2019. Donc, tout ça pour dire qu'il y a une baisse donc, du commerce mondial. Les données précises donc, vous seront envoyées mardi, j'espère, en fin de matinée. Si c'est avant, bien sûr, je vous les enverrai dès lundi. On est en train de finaliser le document. Il y a également dans cet update une analyse de l'offre de produits liés à la COVID-19 et elle montre que les pays à revenus moyens et faibles ont été largement exclus de l'accès à ces produits. Il y a aussi dans ce document, qui est très court, une mesure de l'impact sur les importations et exportations des principales économies entre janvier et septembre. Les principales économies sont le Brésil, la Fédération de Russie, l'Inde, la Chine, l'Afrique du Sud, les États-Unis, le Japon, République de Corée et Union européenne. Voilà, c'est un document court, donc on vous enverra une alerte média. On ne prévoit pas de briefing sur ce document, mais bien sûr, les économistes seront disponibles pour répondre à vos questions. Le document fait aujourd'hui 8 pages, il y a beaucoup de graphiques, donc c'est un texte d'environ 4 pages, c'est assez court. Et je vous promets de vous l'envoyer dès qu'il est prêt, sous embargo, d'ici mercredi, heure d'embargo que je vais vous préciser en tout début de semaine. Voilà, merci beaucoup. Les notes seront en anglais, pardon.
Merci beaucoup, merci Catherine. I am looking at possible questions, but I don't see any, neither online or in the room. So, thank you. I would like to thank all our speakers today. It was a long briefing, but it was very interesting. And I thank everybody who has participated, including our guests, and wish you, if there are no other questions, which I don't see, I wish you a very good weekend. Thank you.